preach such a controversial subject that congregations would be up in arms and so on. Is that evident?
Well, all I know is I've heard Dr. Swift say that. I wasn't present at the time, but I've heard him say that.
No, you can get the National Geographic magazine. They're a wealth of information if you know what you're looking for.
Yes.
And they show these, especially in Pompeii, in Italy, they show the tile floors, again in color, like the picture you show of the old Canaanite king of Assyria.
Yeah.
And they show the ruling class in those areas, also in Greece and on Crete, at certain times at least. And almost inevitably, they show blue-eyed, fair-skinned Caucasian people.
Yes. Well, the other group went on to the basin of the Volga River and settled there for a considerable time. In the later 300s A.D., they drove out the tribe of the Alans, who had lived between the Volga and the Don rivers. And you remember that in the 400s, you had the Alans invading Italy, along with several of the other Germanic tribes. So they took over the space, the Huns did, between the Volga and the Don rivers. Then they pushed on west later, driving the Ostrogoths and Visigoths westward before them to the Danube River. And you first pick up the Goths entering the Roman Empire when they moved in and took over most of the Danube Valley. Rome tried in vain to hold it. Roman armies were just smashed, and so Rome ceded to the Visigoths quite a territory in the Danube Valley on condition they would stay there and give up their warfare. They made it part of the treaty that the Goths were to lay down their arms. So, of course, any time a people is disarmed, invariably the same thing happened. The Romans didn't respect their word at all. They badly mistreated the Goths, and of course in those days it didn't take much of a forge to produce weapons of war. You didn't need a big $150 million factory to turn them out. Any blacksmith with a bit of iron and an anvil could turn out as good a sword as the next fellow had. So you found the Goths then, pushed forward by the Huns behind them, moving on into the home of the Roman Empire in the early 400s. Well, the Huns kept moving in and spreading out. By 432 A.D., they were collecting a large annual tribute from Rome as a bribe to keep them from coming further west. So, when Attila came to power in 444 A.D., he spread out to the southward. He devastated an area from the Black Sea to the Mediterranean. He defeated the Byzantine Emperor Theodosius II in three terrific, desperate battles. He even besieged Constantinople. But he wasn't trained in siege warfare, and he had none of the weapons necessary for besieging a walled city, so he finally had to abandon the siege. Theodosius, however, ceded to him a large amount of territory south of the Danube River, which puts it on the southwestern side. And Theodosius also paid a large annual tribute of the Huns to keep them from coming back to Constantinople. Then in 451 A.D., in alliance with Genseric, the king of the Vandals, he resumed his march westward. He invaded Gaul. Now, remember that in those days you didn't have so much a national identity as we understand it today. It wasn't a nation, it was a kingdom. It was ruled by a king, and it did what the king wanted to do. And if the king decided to make war against some of their blood relatives, why, he led his nation out to war against them. Now, here Genseric had led his Vandals out of Gaul through Spain into Africa, and he knew that some of his fellow Germanic tribes were there, but that didn't matter. He was out for loot. As long as he could reward his warriors with the loot of conquered places, why, he kept the army loyal to him. Well, they invaded Gaul and got as far as Chalon in France, where the Romans, who were assisted now at this time by the Visigoths, under the Visigoth king Theodoric I, the combined Roman and Visigoth force held probably the most terrific battle in all history. Historians of that day say that over 200,000 Huns were killed in that battle. Now, admit that that was probably an exaggerated estimate. But even so, it ranks as one of the greatest, if not the greatest, of all the battles of ancient history. So in 451, they were turned back, and the Visigoth Roman force pursued them back to the Rhine River. Now, they had not only a good deal of the valley of the Rhine, but of course they occupied it all the way south up to the headwaters of the Rhine up near Switzerland. And again, in the mountains that have their start up in that region, you come into the headwaters of the Danube, and then as they poured down into Italy, you come to the River Po. The River Po has its headwaters in the great mountain ridge that runs north-south down Italy, and it flows in a generally easterly direction till it empties into the Adriatic Sea. So here, these three great rivers with their headwaters, the fountains of water, were covered by this terrible blight of the Hun invasion. A blight it was. It was Attila's boast that the grass never grew again where his horse's hoofs had trod. And that's about what he did to the land that he went through. Total devastation, senseless. They didn't know whether they wanted to stay and keep the land or whether they wanted to move on, so they devastated it till it was in such condition there was no point in their trying to stay there. Well, in 452, Attila invaded Italy and advanced on the city of Rome. But before he got there, the Romans sent a deputation out to meet him. The emperor offered an enormous tribute, bribe, to spare the city, and Pope Leo I went along as part of the embassy, and his diplomatic efforts are credited with probably being the persuasive thing that caused Attila to turn back. Anyway, Rome was spared from being occupied by the Huns. But the next year, 453, Attila died while he was preparing another attack on Rome. And the death of Attila broke up the Hun invasion. He was the one chieftain who could hold them all together. And when he was gone, the other chiefs who were willing to serve under him were not willing that one of their own number should rise to a position of supremacy. Each one said, well, I'm as important as he is, I should be the leader, with the result that nobody was able to be a leader. And the Huns finally moved back into the steppes of Central Asia. Not all of them, though. Some of them enlisted in the Roman armies. Remember that by this time, Rome was entirely unable to maintain an effective army made up of Roman citizens. And she was hiring mercenary soldiers, mostly from the various Germanic tribes, but when some of the Huns were willing to enlist in the Roman forces, they were taken in. So the third part of the rivers and the third part of the fountains of waters were occupied. And if ever an invasion was a bitter thing, this was it. And the loss of life was extremely heavy. Many men died of the waters because they were made bitter. So we go on to the fourth trumpet, Revelation 8, verse 12. And the fourth angel sounded, and the third part of the sun was smitten, and the third part of the moon, and the third part of the stars, so as the third part of them was darkened, and the day shone not for a third part of it, and the night likewise. Well, this pictures the extinguishment of all the power and glory of the Western Roman Empire within one century. In 379 AD, the empire was first split into Eastern and Western portions. The Western ruled from Rome and the Eastern from Constantinople. Theodosius the Great ruled both halves from Constantinople between 392 and 395 AD. But thereafter, there were always the two separate portions of the Roman Empire. From about 400 AD, the provinces simply disintegrated into chaos and anarchy from the combination of the excessive taxation from Rome and the barbarian invasions. In History of Nations, Volume 4, page 116, it says of the condition during this period, Gaul had suffered much from the incursions of the barbarians and from civil wars during the last half century, and this distress led to the insurrection of the Bagandi, or rustic banditti. For several years, the country was overrun with troops of famished and furious marauders who attacked all property, and in the case of Autun, sacked and destroyed one of the chief centers of Gaulish civilization. The insurrection at length died out, but the imperial government failed to learn from it the urgent necessity of devising some less exhaustive system of taxation. It has been the history of all important nations that they were not truly conquered by force from without. They collapsed from internal rottenness to the point where it wasn't too big a job to invade and conquer them from without. For a good century, in the provinces, there was very little law or authority existing outside of the walled cities themselves. The power of Rome, shrinking from the great boundaries of the empire to just in and near the city of Rome, and out in the provinces, such power as did exist became simply that of these Germanic tribes who occupied the provinces. Odovaker, the chief of an alliance of German tribes, deposed the last Roman emperor of the West, Romulus Augustulus, in AD 476, and instead of claiming the title of emperor for himself, he was acclaimed king of Italy by his soldiers, and that title he took. So there is the final, total end of the western portion of the Roman Empire. This northwestern third of it had reached extinction. So a third of the sun, the empire itself, was darkened. A third of the moon, the ruling power, the emperor, was lost. A third of the stars, the important people, the princes and generals and those in authority, had lost that authority. Now there remained roughly two-thirds in area of the empire, still under the control, nominally at least, of Constantinople. But here, one third, as it points out, had simply reached total destruction. The empire completely ceased to be in that third of it. So you can see that the symbolism of it portrays accurately what actually happened. Now, in the Old Testament, very little of prophecy was given in that form. Mostly it was a plain statement of what was going to happen. Here, the prophecy is given in symbolic form, but as you can see, that symbolism was accurate. It was true prophecy. Anybody have any questions?
This question of 144,000, does that refer to those that are raised up when Christ returns, when he comes with a shout, the voice of the trumpet?
Yes, evidently so. Now, whether 144,000 should be taken as a literal number or not is open to question. There's nothing else in the book of Revelation that's to be taken literally, and so this 12,000 in each of 12 tribes, making the 144,000, 12 multiplied by 1,000 multiplied by 12 again, to emphasize the 12 symbolism which extends through the tribes of Israel. However, if it is to be taken literally, which could be, consider that the people who are to rule in the millennium under the kingship of Jesus Christ, these who are to be his administrative staff, are going to have power such as no tyrant or dictator in all history ever had, because they won't be limited to sending out some soldiers to compel what they say to be done. They'll have control over the forces of nature even. You remember the prophet Elijah saying to Ahab, there will be no rain in Israel these next 3 years except when I give the word. And he made good. He brought the nation to its knees through famine. Now, power of that sort cannot be trusted to people who are arrogant by nature and want to throw their weight around and show how terrible and important I am. On the other hand, that power is given because at times it has to be used drastically. And if you put it into the hands of some timid Casper Milquetoast, you've accomplished nothing at all. There are plenty of people who wouldn't abuse that power. They simply wouldn't have the moral courage to use it at all and would be totally unfit. Morally unfit to have that power entrusted to them. They'd be every bit as bad as the arrogant who would abuse it, because they'd produce equal trouble. Now, starting with Adam and coming down to our own day, if you can find 144,000 men out of all who lived in that time who are fit to be trusted with that sort of power, I'd say you're doing quite well.
I know some sects or denominations of religions, like Jehovah's Witnesses, they claim that 140,000 are the ones that are to be brought up into heaven to rule the kingdom on earth from heaven.
Well, the Jehovah's Witnesses started out by saying that, of course, the 144,000 were entirely members of the Jehovah's Witness Kingdom Church. And then after a while, their own numbers exceeded 144,000. And they had the embarrassing confession that a great many thousands of their people weren't fit.
Well, it also excludes women, because it specifically states that these are male virgins.
Oh, yeah.
If there's any Jehovah's Witnesses or women, they're just left out all together.
Oh, I don't think so, because I know a woman who expects to be one of those 144,000.
Well, ask her how she expects to become a male virgin.
Mr. Grayson?
some Bible expositors claim that there are two distinct groups of 144,000, and the one that the prophet refers to is not the same as Revelation.
Well, I don't think there's any reason to believe that they are two separate groups. That theory, it seems to me, if you're going to apply it and say every time you come to another mention of the same number or the same size or people doing the same thing or something, it's always a different one, becomes destructive. You take this blasphemous thing called the Bible in the hands of its creators by the Jew rabbi Moses Gibberi, who, by the way, is living in Tel Aviv at present. He uses the typical Talmudic rabbinical analysis of the Bible. He tries to prove that there are a practically infinite number of Yahwehs, or as he calls it, Jehovah, each of whom is the one and only God, because the way he analyzes it, every time the name is used, why, it always is a different one. Now, you notice how often in the Old Testament, especially in the books of Moses, where the law is being given, God keeps emphasizing these commandments. Thou shalt do this, or thou shalt not do that. I am Yahweh thy God. So, two verses on, he says the same thing again. So, Moses Gibberi says, well, you see, the two couldn't be the same person. So it has to be the next in succession of these Yahweh gods. So there's an almost infinite number of them, according to him. Well, now, actually, if you accept the validity of that kind of reasoning, to get these two different groups of 144,000, why, you really haven't much ground for criticizing Moses Gibberi, because he's using the same reasoning. Anybody else? Yes?
You mentioned that the Franks were a mixture of seven types of Teutonic people. Would that be seven tribes mixed into the Franks?
Quite probably.
Now, could they be the people whom a person runs across in history, like you mentioned the Alemanni, the Bo'ii, the Sueli, the Cimbri, and others that I can't recall?
Well, remember that in their march from Scythia on, in fact, in Scythia, we have no adequate indication that they really preserved their separate tribal identity. They very probably were somewhat mixed up. Now, the tribe of Dan undoubtedly left by sea, because it wasn't too hard a job to move on to the shores of the Black Sea, and there, in ships, go on out into the Mediterranean and around the coast of Europe to Denmark, and probably some of them did not go that way and went overland. And you notice that there are a number of place names, particularly in the Slavic languages, because they are mostly in the area that later was overrun and settled by the Slavs, that include Dan as a part of the name, like Danube and so on. And there's been speculation that the name came from the fact that it was people of the tribe of Dan who named it. There isn't clear, conclusive proof as to the overland march of the tribe of Dan. But certainly, when they did get to what we call Denmark, and they called Danmark, they still had the name and evidently knew who they were. But now the rest of them coming around the north shore of the Mediterranean, up the Danube Valley and on into Germany, very probably they were pretty badly mixed up. Now they would break into smaller sub-tribes unquestionably, because there had to be leadership and government. But they weren't able, I would say, to organize on the great scale that would account for an entire tribe like Manasseh or Ephraim or something of that sort. These were undoubtedly smaller groups. So that you have, of these various Germanic sub-tribes, you'll find they add up to more than the number of the tribes of Israel, because they were sub-tribes rather than complete tribes.
I believe, Mr. Galte, and Frederick Hagerman in his book, Tracing Our Ancestors, mentions that quite great numbers of the Israelites left Palestine even before the Assyrian captivity or deportation, and also even before the Exodus, some of them migrated.
Oh yes, you had some of them who left Egypt before the Exodus. They moved on up the eastern shore of the Mediterranean, and they founded the city of Troy, and what was that other great city they found in Asia Minor? I'll think of the name in a moment. So they did get out ahead of the general exodus of the rest of the tribes on several occasions.
Wasn't there a tribe of Greeks, or so-called Greeks, that were called Danai?
Yeah, the Danai. Yes. And incidentally, there was the coming of civilization to Greece. What few inhabitants they had were evidently of a rather uncivilized sort, until suddenly Greek culture appears with the Danai and a full-blown civilization. And the Greek story of these Danai is that they had come from Egypt. Now, the timing of it would be just shortly before the Exodus. Miletus is the name of that city they founded in Asia Minor, I was trying to think of.
History tells that the Barbarossa came from Miletus, and that they were not what people think they were, Turks. They were blue-eyed, blonde people.
Yes. Undoubtedly, they were our people, because Miletus founded a fair-sized empire of its own. They occupied a large portion of Spain, and Milesian mercenary troops were hired by Egypt as border guards. Miletus had its own gold coinage, with the Lion of Judah stamped on it, by the way. And from Spain, the Milesians moved on into Ireland, which they conquered, and the Milesians were the ruling people in Ireland up until the conquest by the Norman English. Let's see, that was around, a little before or a little after 1200 A.D. The Irish today, whose names begin with Mac or with O, are descendants of the Milesians. That's where those names came from. I'm through.
This week, Dr. Talbot on the Biola Hour was answering questions, and someone inquired about the Anglo-Saxon Israel theory. His only answer was that point out the absurdity of the people in the British Isles being Ephraimites, would by the journey overseas come to America and suddenly become Manassites. And he said that absurdity ought to answer.
Never occurred to him that there might have been both Ephraim and Manasseh in the British Isles together for a while.
He didn't.